and a very big welcome to you all. Thanks a lot for coming out to the second of our sort of season of Philip Larkin events. We're delighted this evening to be hosting the Faber New Poets Tour. This is Thursday. It must be Hull for them. I think they enjoyed the coming over so much they went over the Humber Bridge twice. And so you can see these are real poets who are never mind the cost. Let's just appreciate the glory that is Hull. We're delighted to have them with us. I'm going to actually let Matthew Hollis, who is a formidable poet himself, who will be giving us a reading in the second half. He's also the commissioning editor for Faber and one of the presiding gurus behind this particular evening. So please welcome Matthew Hollis.
Thank you very much, Martin. Thank you very much to Martin and David, in fact, for having us up here, and also to Maria, who's kindly looking after pamphlets by the door, which are very much around and on sale for you to take home this evening if you'd like to. I thought I'd just tell you a little bit about what the project is, and then you'll hear from the poets, and I'll tell you a little bit about the shape of the evening as well. Faber New Poets is a programme that's a partnership with the Arts Council. Faber has never worked with the Arts Council before. And what the programme is designed to do, really, is to identify poets that are yet to arrive at a first collection, poets of outstanding promise, and give them everything that we think might be useful as they develop their art and their craft towards the first collection. And that takes the form of three particular things. It takes the form of a bursary to enable them to take time out of what they're doing and concentrate on the writing as much as they possibly can. It also takes the form of mentorship, and the four poets you'll hear from tonight are spending 6 months working with the poet of their choice in a one-to-one mentorship style session, and perhaps we'll talk a little bit about that in the second half. And the third thing that you see at the back table and here are the pamphlets that Faber are publishing. And these come out this week. And to celebrate the publication of them, we have hired a minibus and are going around the country pretending to be a kind of rock band. I was just talking to Cliff Forshaw in the foyer, and we realised that the path we're taking is actually an ampersand. We started in Norwich, and then we went to Cambridge and Oxford, and here we are tonight, and tomorrow, Durham. After that, down to Ilkley, Manchester, and back down to London. Well, it's a bad ampersand, but, you know, it's close. It seems to me that poets seem rarely to arrive fully formed at the ages that novelists often do. It's not uncommon to come across novelists making their debut in their 20s. It is more unusual to find poets doing that. It does happen, of course, and some in their teens too. But often the process of a first collection is a long one, and 10 or 12 years is not uncommon in the assembly of a first collection. And through this programme, we wish the four poets here all the very best of luck in everything that they're doing. And Faber will support them in an old-fashioned way as far as we possibly can all the way through that. This evening's plan is this, that the four poets will read in the first half. Fiona Benson will open the reading. Toby Martinez de las Rivas will be following. Heather Phillipson will read after that. And Jack Underwood will close the first half. There'll be an interval where you can have a drink and look at the works. And then in the second half, I'll pop up for a short while, and then we'll have a kind of in conversation, I hope with you and also with the poets in the chairs behind me that you see. So if there are things that you're really keen to know either about their work or the process of working towards a first collection, that'll be the time to do it. And then we'll finish on some poems at the end of the evening. So that's the running order for tonight. In a moment, you'll hear from Toby, after that, Heather, and after that, Jack. But could I ask you first to please welcome Fiona Benson.
Thank you so much for having us here today. And thank you to Matthew for driving all this way today. I thought I'd start with a couple of poems that were written just after a visit to Thailand, shortly after the tsunami, and they kind of came out of hearing people's accounts of that time and what had happened, and also the kind of refurbishment or rebuilding that we were seeing at the same time. The poems deal with that. the calm. We should have known. The dogs all gone, and the cats, and the sea sucked back like that, holding its breath. But hungover and at a loose end, we were messing around, prodding at the bellies of the bloatfish that had beached to make them inflate. There were fleets of them, liver and tan, their taut skins shimmering, blown. Jellyfish lay, blistering in the sun. Translucent crabs surged inland. About a mile on, that final sign, sea urchins nesting in their own dropped spines. Amandara. Everything is new. Even this morning, women were still planting seedlings between rains, pressing in orchids with their bare hands. Even the palm trees imported from the mainland are still surrounded by darker cribs of earth. We meet and order singers. The cicadas are ringing, shell-pink geckos twitch on the ceiling, while bats flicker in at the fringes, picking off moths, and the workers' dogs pat at bugs and toads just beyond the light. We're given rice and steaming curries laced with lemongrass. The beer bottles knock against our teeth as we toast. We can sense them in the dark, exiled but listening, a stiff, wild current of salt and longing. This next poem is taken from three poems addressed to Vincent van Gogh, which seems very grand, but this is Yellow Room at Arles. I was back in your yellow room at Arles, an ochre cube with a bed like a crib and your paintings all over the walls. But that's not it. I wanted to tell you that it's so much worse, that the times of clarity and grace are more and more remote, that I'm losing ground to the dark. So I've dug my way back to your golden room, your wounded girl, your damned and lovely prostitute. Come to sleep it out, teepeed in your scarlet blanket, with the lamplight dimmed to a red bordello warmth and a chair against the door. We'll talk or fuck or sit and flip cards. Whatever you want, just ferry me through unharmed, uncut. The next couple of poems concern a miscarriage, and then I'll move on to something lighter to finish with. Prayer. I saw you like a hare, stripped and jugged in the wine of your own blood, your tail a rudder, steering you through burgundy and juniper, your eyes gummed shut. Tadpole, stripling, elver, don't let the drag tides pull you under, but root in, bed down, tucked behind my pelvic bone, rocked in the emptying stoop of my womb. Sheep. She's lying under a low wind, bedded in mud and afterbirth, her three dead lambs knotted in a plastic bag. Crows have pecked out her arse, and now the hen that's been circling all morning tugs at a string of birth meat like she's pulling a worm in the yard. I can't not watch. I too lay stunned in my own dirt, the miscarried child guttering out, soaking the mattress in blood. I was afraid to look down for what I might see, a human face, a fist. Yet once it was done, I got up, gathered my bedding and walked. And finally, this is Corpo Santo. I went snorkeling for the first time and was completely thrilled to be swimming with all these fish. So essentially, this is a poem about snorkeling. Corpo Santo. The ocean surface flexes and I am schooled with the fish, flanked by the tail and tilt of their angled balance, the cold intimacies of their flesh. I could dedicate myself to this, the pursuit of cadences in salt and warmth, and the sinuous will of this many-ribboned shoal as it streams into rods of turquoise and gold. I pitch between the water's sides, its massy, burnished sheets, and I'm lost to its permissions and slipways and its taste, as the milky spores and coral globes of last night's spawning season thread through my fingers and briefly luminesce, as if I had somehow found a back door and uninvited entered grace. Thank you.
Hello. I'm going to say the dreaded words. I'm just going to read one very long poem. But if you're good at maths, as most writers are, then you'll be able to count down with this one, so there'll always be light at the end of the tunnel. It has two quotations connected with it. And the first one is by William Paley on his Sermon of the State After Death, and it goes like this. When animals which lived underwater afterwards live in air, their bodies change almost entirely, so as hardly to be known by any one mark of resemblance to their former figure, as, for example, from worms and caterpillars to flies and moths. These changes take place in consequence of the unalterable rule that the body be fitted to the state. Now, our present bodies are by no means fitted for heaven. The second quote is from Flann O'Brien's The Third Policeman. I was once acquainted with a tall man, he said to me at last, that had no name either. And you are certain to be his son and the heir to his nullity and all his nothings. And this poem's called 21 Prayers for Weak or Fabulous Things. As snow falls, as the first snow of this year falls and falls beyond all light and knowledge, I pray for Rufus, corrupted by blood parasites, whose liver is corrupted and whose eyes are uncorrupted by swiveling in the weak light. I speak this prayer into the inflamed sun. Secondly, I pray for stooping David, who sees his dead sister walking in the bedroom each morning, up and down, a shadow of herself. I pray for all things that shed their skins, for snakes, for cicadas and silkworms clasped to branches and hidden in rattling bushes. Thirdly, I pray for a babbling drunk fisherman wearing no pants, dredged from the tyne, who swore ever after that by praying to Cuddy, he was able to call silver trout from the river to throw themselves from their element into his, and there they flop, gasping. Fourthly, I pray for a war protester picketing the sage, whose banner is stitched with cluster bombs like falling seeds, having the real viridian sting of black pansies opening. I pray for all things that open and follow the sun, its star track raked in the winter sky. Fifthly, I pray for the ghost of Rini and the living ghost of Mary in the final blank stage of Alzheimer's, nodding, clucking, and fumbling. I pray for the sunflower, thin petals opening, head bowed, face nodding imperceptibly nightward. It has arms too, to hold itself. Sixthly, I pray for a humble yellowhammer, who when he sings, sings in English, a little bit of bread and no cheese. This is acknowledgement of the body's need and the body's need to sing. I pray for the ghost of Barry McSweeney, which has a bird's throat. Seventhly, I pray for the sparrow, tongue-cut, whirring, who in Egypt had a jackal's garish blunt head and carried dead children across the river. But in England, he's a merry fat fellow. I listen to his declining brotherhood at Middlezoy. There is one fewer every day. Eighthly, I pray for Jimmy, who strokes Mary's hands and looks into Mary's empty shell each Wednesday, also on her birthday and at Christmas. I pray for all things whose meat's scooped out. Eight is a sign of infinity, and also the sum of YHVH, double barrels of emptiness. Ninthly, I pray to the memory of the prodigious monster of Ravenna, and prophesy with Arthur Clarke that one day people will do away with their bodies and encode themselves as quanta or pure mental self-image. The wing is for fickleness, the claw greed, the horn pride. Tenthly, I pray for the last few seconds of a cold August, when the world is stilled, a sullen body of water that brings forth flies and creeping beasts to my fingertips, my tongue a water snail with soft horns poking its head from between my lips, a prince of dusk and muscle. My 11th prayer is for Migdale, checking the hooves of his sheep for rot separating the hoof's heel, sole, and wall from their attachments to the foot, and for the sheep like amputees hobbling and nibbling at lung flukes and brain worms, and some fall down, shaking. My 12th prayer is for the fledgling rooks shawled by ants beneath the nest, for the membra over the black pods of their eyes, for their crackable elbows and white beaks, for the boot I bring down on them. Let me love best of all the creeping things that creepeth. My 13th prayer is for the memory of Nicholas Flew, who saw the face of the Lord deformed by anger, and whose own face was transformed into a death mask by that vision of lacerations. He shuts his house to light. Today, even the sparrows cannot bear to look at me. My 14th prayer is for psoriatics. For all the world is a clear mirror they fall apart in day after day. For every beautiful thing grows to a scaly deformity, and even the face of the sun glows scabrous and repugnant. But like pythons, they slough off their skins and slither out. My 15th prayer is for you, Isabel, eaten by distance. I see the shape of your pumping heart, and it is the shape of the winter cherry shaken by a heave of wind. Its blossom blows off, acquiescence in the bough, but my heart is a bird high in the canopy, a false lapwing. My 16th prayer is for the solitary writhing bee that I found in the allotment, like an aeronaut slumped in the collapsed riggings of his machine. He thumped his sting once into the sodden ground to vent his fury and is free to go. I am not free to go, nor will I be released. My 17th prayer is to the memory of Christopher Smart, kneeling in a cloud of honeybees at Staindrop to pray, or carving the song to David into the walls at Bedlam with a workaday burin, a nail or key, and with his fingertips rubbing charcoal into the scratches. My 18th prayer is for the glass ghosts of Rudolf and Leo Blaschke, combinations of moonlight and utile organ, tendrils of pink glass hunting down their prey by security light and night vision, an inward ocean. I say this prayer as the clouds shift to smother the moon. My 19th prayer is for that one who sat in watch on the top stair when the child came home, to guard against the visit of the devil, whose raw stare counteracts supernatural malice, and who, after the dragon and the owl, is the most canny and puissant of all living beasts. My 20th prayer is cobbled from 19 fragments. 4 of flesh, 2 of wood. 1 is a shred of paper from which a peregrine takes wing. Another is its falling. 10 are made of air, and the 8th means nothing. There is a gap between each one where the breath comes. Lastly, I pray for the makers of prayers, which are poems we say to ourselves in the hard times, cold times, dry times, tucked in tenements and tower blocks, in the lockups of our bodies, between the soil and the sky, falling and falling like snowflakes beyond all light and knowledge. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Heather Phillipson. I thought that to introduce myself tonight, I would start by reading a poem about my family, which puts my kind of upbringing into context. And it's a rather strange family, like a lot of families are, but mine's strange in a particular way. It was my birthday last week, for example, and as a present, my brother sent me a photograph of himself pretending to be a meerkat. So I guess that tells you a little bit, and this will elaborate further. Relational epistemology. It's whatever you want it to be, said my father, after he bisected My Little Pony and used her in a sculpture. At bedtime, he read me Kafka's short fiction. All men are not idiots, my mother advised, but beware of structuralists. Life will never be a matter of signifiers and signs. She gave up her copy of Someday My Prince Won't Come with a dedication. Darling, don't be limited by propositional modes of representation. Kiss, kiss. Preparation of rich cherry Genoa was methodological. My father quoted Merleau-Ponty. The toucher, touching, touched. His hands around the mixing bowl, she sifted sugar. It helped them contextualize the relationship between self and other. Phenomenology at the dinner table was not unusual. My brother queried so-called pepper, so-called ketchup, ingested as if objective fact. The color red is not universal. Mainly, my sister slept at any hour. See, said my mother, the claim that all experience might be mediated by language is one all women know to be preposterous. And besides, Wittgenstein is dead. Over dessert, however, she absolved him on account of her cake and his raisins. As Ludwig said, raisins may be the best part of a cake, but a bag of raisins is not better than a cake. My cake isn't, as it were, thinned out raisins, as you will know from experience. The same brother that I just mentioned, who I should add is an older brother and therefore has no excuse, also said to me at the end of a relationship, in order to console me, I suppose, all the more time for poetry, which is probably quite a good consolation for single people. So this poem was kind of written in response to that and the idea that actually, yeah, you know, what's better than poetry? You know, relationships are nothing in comparison. Devoted, hopelessly. The only men it's safe for me to love are dead. O'Hara, Stevens, Berryman. They send me to my desk or down the road to get black grapes, fit and ideas. Simon's hair was black and untamable. Tuesdays I stop at the library for poetry. Hair's all very well, ideas take commitment. At 28, Charlotte Bronte feared herself a spinster. Married soon after, died in pregnancy. I make marginalia. women are getting older all the time, etc. In snow outside my window, Sam wrote, "Marry me." Days pass with such things. I didn't hold his hand tightly. He left me a message. We all need to be editors. I read the index of first lines aloud, tell myself I need to be alone to be more, and meet Ben, by chance, by the derelict job centre. He tells me, "There's a lot of bad love going around." I make a note. On the ground, a snail is a comma or an apostrophe, dependent on context. It's in the path of footsteps. I pick it up, put it down, pick it up, take a detour from pedestrians diverted by romantic fictions. That poem was about the breakup of a relationship, and perhaps when I tell you the next poem was about being with a boyfriend and ignoring him in favour of a grasshopper and feeling slightly in love with the grasshopper, you'll understand why. Insect Life of Bergamo. He must be after some small, irresponsible glory or a final fall in the face of the wind, that upside-down grasshopper on the railing behind your ear. His definite position recalls the last scene of an Italian opera. How high he has come to adjourn at this man-made structure to hold us in close-up, inverted. No matter that I brought you to this panoramic outpost for an intimate moment, nature always intrudes on sentiment, sidetracks my romance. I suspect that I am in love with his recklessness when minutes go by and I can't tell where each one finishes. Keen and precarious, he is above ingenuity and excellence and posterity and boredom and the impossibility of communication. Something is imminent. Listen to how the traffic behind us sounds like Puccini. He stands alone and green on gunmetal grey, out of context in the vanity of the afternoon sun, and really means it. The next poem was written as part of a commission for the British Film Institute in London, and I had to write a poem based on some films in their Media Tech collection. One of which I chose to write about was about British newspaper articles. And there was an article that particularly interested me, which was about a man called Mr. Turner, who divorced his wife after their 30-year marriage because she'd rearranged the furniture every day for the last 30 years. Apparently she had a mania for blocking up doors. So this is me kind of imagining what might have been going on in her head behind those doors, what she might have been doing. The routine. She has the catastrophe of her character, too much time. Her underwear, not as nice as the au pairs, has blown from off the line. Mrs. Turner choreographs the furniture in order of what matters. The sofa's against the door, her heart beats fierce against the dresser, the armchair's rendezvous. Little amendments are little less than everything, and Natalia does not dust properly, and there's a twopence piece behind the cushion, and Mr. Turner makes no effort to fulfil her, the philanderer. His photo will go back on the mantle, and his eyes will follow her, and Mrs. Turner will take her clothes off and tug at the curtains and lie on the rug as if the rug is responsible for the lack of requited love in the world. He's bought her no coordinating knickers. He's bought her no coordinating bras. The underside of the coffee table is above her. Four legs, a mahogany belly. It straddles her on the floor, makes dimples in the pile. I'm going to end with a poem that's about travel in some respects, and I was kind of hoping that strange noise would continue in the background there. It reminded me a bit of being in an aeroplane, and this poem is about being in an aeroplane. It's one of those those experiences when you're in an aeroplane and you have several seats to yourself and then somebody comes and sits next to you and wants to talk to you for several hours when all you want to do is fall asleep or watch terrible films on a tiny television screen. This is what might happen if you gave into that situation. The distance between England and America. Much could begin like this. A large man, his tie slackened, voice buoyed up by altitude. My mind's elsewhere. The air conditioning, it's cold. Above the Atlantic, he bellows long vowels to me, and I'm cabined, window-seated, polite. With my English tone, I'm inadvertently provocative. No more salted pretzels for me, thanks, Jeff. At the sound of Charles Darwin's bassoon, earthworms apparently writhed. Jeff booms, Pittsburgh, golf clubs, his search for a wife. I twist in my seat, suggest something in my movement of all evolution. His blanket folds back like an invitation to navy shadows and polyester. Heat and anything could happen under there. Perfect timing. Oh, take your loafers off, Jeff. Throw them in the aisle. Your gusto can conquer my boredom. Our bed can be the sky. I'm warming up. We won't be sleeping. For almost 9 hours beneath United Airlines covers, we'll share everything but thought. In the morning, white bread rolls and Columbus, Ohio. Women distribute plastic cutlery in the night. Thank you.
Hello. Theology. He tried to think about the zoo, the bird he'd seen with an anvil head, slinking lizards in the reptile house. It had been a good day. But he remembered the panther enclosure, where he had waited for 30 minutes, staring up at a dark hut hidden in trees. Suppose there was no panther. This next poem is a kind of reclamation of the word weasel or the noun weasel, which is often associated with sort of devious characters and weaselly types, well, appropriately. So this is taking a Chaucerian weasel allusion that I found, where he talks about somebody having weasel hips or a weasel waist. It's in the Miller's Tale, so this is a kind of term of affection. It's a love poem. Weasel. So, weasel, it has come to this. To your thighs like tall glasses of milk, your biscuit hair, eyes that are like any kind of deep water. It has come to those coiled, snaking guts we had when we were younger still, those balled-up sock guts of an afternoon stolen back from college. It has come to the spastic, ticking urges rising through the skin at the simplest repositioning of your weasel hips, or the one in 27 kisses I might land about your mouth of the right temperature and diction. Was I even hungry once for eating? Were you ever not the end to all fasts? The next poem I'm going to read is called Your Horse, and it's kind of imagines a scenario where you meet. It's difficult to introduce this one now because subsequently, since all the reviews have come out or begin to emerge, I've heard so many different reinterpretations of it that I'm not sure I know what it's about anymore or how to introduce it without sending you all off around down the wrong track. So I'll just read the poem. It's probably easier that way. Your horse has arrived and is bending himself into the room, refolding his legs. I knuckle his nose, which reminds me of the arm of a chair. He is talking low and steady, rolling back an eye towards his chestnut brain. Man words are climbing his long throat. I show him to the bathroom and he is embarrassed. Next, he is hoofing through your photo album. There are more of me than of him. We are crunching on polo mints together and remembering the way your body used to move. I'm a big fan of Bonnie Prince Billy, the country singer. And this poem is a kind of response to his music, but not a response to the music itself, more the kind of the effect of the music on a given context within a relationship. And kind of, it's basically saying what he's also singing without knowing that he's singing it. Bonnie Prince Billy. He is also singing how I will split the atom and leave it for you cleaved in two on the breadboard like an apple. We'll peel your star sign off the sky, dissolve and serve it hot in a cup. He sings how ugly and complex I have become, sitting at the table, gripping the stupidity of wood. He sings how deeply I am weakened by a single drip of water falling from the end of your nose and soaking into my jeans like an excuse into the wider scheme of things. I was watching the news coverage of Iraq, the war there, and I suddenly realised that all my life I've been hearing these terms like shock and awe, these code names, Desert Storm and Proud Eagle and all these kind of things. And it seemed like a fairly zany world, really. And I imagine whether there might be a poet somewhere writing those, probably not. But this is imagining meeting the man who writes the military code names. And what do you do? Write code names, military mainly. Operation Blunt Tongue, that was me. Spirit Hat, Yard Mile, them too. I'm jacking it in next month. Civvy Street, open shirt, slip-on shoes. I've a job lined up in colours. How about Burnt Viscous? Black Jam? Would you paint your hall with easy money? These days, there's little left to call. What beautiful blue eyes you have. And I'll finish with a longer poem, which imagines an encounter with the devil, one of the devils anyway, the one with horns and things. Wildebeest. In the wilderness, the devil came to me. Big antique horns, a swinging red dick, and my father's angry voice. He offered me grapes, a puckered teat, loose with wine and milk. I spat, and he spat back my mother's maiden name. I pressed on, urged my feet. Satan changed tack, swam me in sensation. My first time drunk, the heat of a well-spun lie. Boyhood glimpsed between a hairdresser's breasts, the smell of shampoo and cigarette breath. Then, from a tuck in his arse, he pulled rein and a chip shop cue, the taste of shandy, wet football boots dangled by the laces, acorns and conkers tumbling from their spouts. I gave a shout, a kind of grief escaping, and from astride his chin appeared two slim girl's legs, akimbo his beard. He opened his ripe mouth, folded his tongue back and in, wriggling pleasure from himself, stamping it out on the bare earth, braying. I felt hunger folding in my gut. The devil swung his hips, each jerk giving birth to a pair of round pert tits. I'm a good man, I railed, and each flesh sack withered and slapped on the ground, sizzled on the grit heat of rock. I heard waves, an ocean then, but it was Satan shushing with a four-knuckled finger to his lips. A breeze faltered and caught over. Seabirds swung in long arcs. The devil leaned in and touched me, quietly, here and then here. Softly, he drew a perfect circle on the ground, bid me dream my mortal desire inside it. I took out a photograph of you, my love. Showed him grace, fixed and flattened, wrapped in a scarf and coat last week when the camera pinned you to the sea and I watched it happen from behind the lens, my breath holding you there a moment. I showed the devil your photo and he wept. Flies fell buzzing from his cheeks. You tempted and turned him, and the sun strained to look as the perfect circle became a pool of water, hardened into a mirror, the mirror I've been staring into since, in our bathroom, in our flat, with the wilderness of seconds between us. Thank you.